Joe Nesbø was one of the world's best-selling crime fiction writers. Joe is from Norway. He's written 9 books so far that feature his signature detective character, Harry Hole. The latest one is called Phantom. I have to assume that Joe Nesbø is a seriously driven man because he tends to be very, very good at just about everything he tries. At one point, he was going to be a Premier League European soccer player. Then he got a degree in economics and business and became a stockbroker. Then he formed a band which became hugely popular in Norway, and suddenly he was a pop star. And from there he made the leap into fiction. And his books have attracted strong praise, sold millions of copies, and won all sorts of awards. Joe Nesbø asks his readers to follow Harry Hold into some very dark places. And his readers are more than happy to go there. Hi, Joe.
Thanks for having me.
Joe, is Harry Hold disintegrating?
Well, he is falling apart bit by bit. A journalist once called the Harry Hole series the deconstruction of Harry. And I guess that is what the series is about. It's a human being getting damaged, both physically and mentally. Physically, he is getting more and more scars. He's losing body parts. Mentally, he's probably getting driven towards the dark side. He's becoming more and more similar to the people he's chasing. And by now, he probably feels more related to murderers than he does to his colleagues at the police house in Oslo. It gets worse. But then, probably after that, he will go straight to hell. So that is my... That is sort of my plan for Harry.
You love this guy, don't you, clearly?
I do.
I'm serious, too.
Yeah, but in another way, he's sort of an annoying guy. He's much too intense to spend too much time with, so I have to take breaks. I have to take time off from Harry and do other stuff and write other stuff.
Are you planning to kill him?
I won't tell you. But what I can tell you that is that he's not going to have eternal life, and he's not going to resurrect. So when he's dead, he's dead.
Who's doing all these things to Harry Hole? Is it you, the writer, or is it the world you've created for him to live in? The circumstances dictate that to him.
I guess both. I do guess that there's certain rules within the genre that permits me or even commands me to do these things to him. Is that kind of character, that the tortured character, sort of the Jesus of crime fiction, that he takes on all the sin of all the others. He's a guy who's driven by his job, but he also feels all kinds of responsibility. And he blame himself for everything. And in that respect, I guess he's a typical Lutheranian, Scandinavian social democrat. but I think it's more interesting to have a character slowly falling apart than to have one staying, you know, the same hero book after book. So the damage that is done to Harry in one book, he will carry over to the next book.
Are you thinking about how we get old when you do that for Harry Hole? Are you thinking about the aging process when you do this?
Maybe I am. I'm not that conscious about it, but I guess I am. I just passed 50 now, and I guess, what is it Bob Dylan says? I'm not dead yet, but I'm getting there. And I think that the idea of death is more important for me now than it was 10 years ago, and it probably reflects in the books.
There's such an art to writing suspense. Sometimes I wonder if it's a bit like comedy, because there's so much about timing involved in writing suspense. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I actually think that's true. I once talked to a comedian. He explained the concept of timing for me. He said that telling a joke and giving you the punchline is all about timing, of course. But timing, the definition of timing, is giving you the punchline just a fraction of a second before you arrive at the same conclusion, you know. So when you are not laughing at a punchline that is unexpected, but that is expected, but just like a fraction of a second before you knew what was going to be the punchline. And I guess it's the same with writing crime. It's what you want is when you give your reader the solution, he or she will instantly go, oh yes, of course, I was just about to arrive at the same conclusion. So what you want to give them is actually what they didn't know they expected, but they did expect that.
I suppose that affects how you actually put every single word on the page in certain important scenes then.
Oh, yeah. Some scenes, some key scenes, I have to be very careful with my wording. Crime fiction is interesting because unlike other kinds of storytelling or fiction writing, it's about manipulating your reader. And the reader is aware of that, and the reader actually wants to be manipulated. And so there's a sort of magic. You're doing magic tricks, trying to manipulate the reader into looking at your right hand while the trick is being done by the left hand.
I also think sometimes that crime fiction, the reason why we enjoy it so much, particularly when it gets as violent as it can get sometimes, is that it makes us feel like kids again. It makes us frightened of the dark again.
Well, I guess my fuel when I started writing crime fiction was childhood memories and the fear I felt as a child just going down to the cellar and getting potatoes for my mother. You know, those 30 seconds that I spent in the cellar, they sort of developed to 9 novels when I grew up. It's those basic fears that you don't know exactly what you're afraid of. You are certainly afraid of fear itself, but that almost physical pain of being of panicking, of being afraid, that is something that I really use in my novels. In any scene where anybody is afraid, I think that as a writer you have to work like an actor. With every character, you have to find what they feel and what they think and what they are somewhere inside yourself. Even when you're writing about a psychopath, you have to find that little piece, hopefully a little piece, within yourself that is psychopathic. I don't feel afraid that much more now that I'm 51 as I did when I was a child. So I actually have to go back to when I was a child. But I do rock climbing. I probably started with that because of my fear of heights. And that is, you know, one area where I can still feel the pulse of panic. Your heart is running wild. You feel that, you know, fear that your head is trying to tell or explain to you that this is not dangerous. You're not going to fall down. Actually, you're tied in a rope, but your body doesn't agree with that.
Aren't we strange creatures that we'd be attracted to that sort of thing? But we are. Isn't it odd?
I don't know. Maybe it's biological. I mean, if you go back, people, if they didn't feel fear, they probably wouldn't survive. If you didn't have a fear of height, you probably fall down from a rock at some point in life. Fear is useful. That is why we sometimes feel the urge to feel some kind of fear.
Can you remember when you had the first time as a kid, when you were attracted by the macabre, when you were attracted by something strange and weird and violent and dangerous? The first, I don't know, was it a book or a film or something?
Well, I can certainly remember the first time I was fascinated by evil. And I was in first grade. There was a boy sitting on the window row, and he used to catch flies in the windowsill. And then he would use a tweezer to pick off a fly's leg one by one and put it down and see if it could fly. And in the end, he would, of course, pull off the wings. And I was fascinated not only with the idea that he was doing this, but the fact that he had a tweezer, that he had brought a tweezer to the classroom, because I realized that he must have been at home, you know, planning this, thinking that, okay, I should probably bring a tweezer. That's more effective when I'm going to torture these flies. So I was fascinated with this guy, what was going on in his head. Then again, I was, to some extent, like everybody else, curious whether the fly actually could fly if you pulled off, let's say, 3 legs. So I also realized that we all have it in us to a lesser or greater degree, you know, that sort of maybe curiosity, but also that cruelty that comes with curiosity. So that was probably the first time when I started thinking about whether we are evil. And I guess in the childish way, maybe the problem of evil, if God is good, then why is there evil in the world?
So where does evil live then? Do you think there is evil, or people do evil things, Joe?
I think it all has to do with how you define evil. I think that often when we're discussing evil, people mean different things when they say evil. I think there's the passive evil is perhaps only the lack of good, an absence of good, just like in the universe, it's not really cold; it's just an absence of warmth. And if we had been just creatures living all by ourselves, if we hadn't been social creatures, then maybe what we in a society regard as evil and cruelty,
law of the jungle, maybe.
Yeah, it's I guess on that deserted island, that would be just be surviving. That would be what you had to do to survive. But what is more interesting is the active evil, the proactive evil, the person that would go to lengths and really use energy to inflict pain on other people without benefiting from it in any way.
When you talked about the kid taking the time to bring in some tweezers to school to pluck the legs off flies, that's a classic symptom of the growing psychopath, isn't it? The kid who tortures animals. I don't know if a fly really counts as an animal, but the fact that he calmly figured he'd bring in a pair of tweezers.
Yeah. Well, I recently read a research report that sort of concluded, or at least indicated, that children are born aggressive. And people don't become aggressive. They are aggressive to begin with. And what happens is we try to teach them not to be aggressive. And the ones that stays aggressive, they just, didn't get it when they were children. I guess that there's a link between cruelty and the ability to survive too.
Joe, how big a thing was soccer? We call it soccer in this country. Mm. It offends a lot of people because they like us to call it football, I know. How big a thing was that for you as a kid?
It was big. My uncle had played in the Premier League, and he was, of course, the big hero in the family. And he was an inspiration when me and my brother, we started playing soccer at a young age. And it was actually all I was interested in as a teenager. That was soccer. And I didn't really think that much about it, but I realized later that I always saw my future as becoming a professional soccer player. I broke the ligaments in both knees when I was 19, so then I had to come up with a plan B. But up until then, I was a soccer player.
Yeah, you were being tapped to play for Tottenham Hotspur in Britain, weren't you?
Well, that was sort of my idea. That was how I saw my future. So I... for me, it was a big loss when I broke my ligaments in my knees. I'm not sure whether it was that big loss for Tottenham Hotspur. But I did play in the Norwegian Premier League, I guess I had some talent. But when I was 19, it was game over. So
did you panic? That sounds like, that happens to you at 19. You think you've got your whole life
I think, ahead of you? I think when you're 19, you're pretty good at refocusing. When you're 19, everything is up in the air anyway. So, so I broke the ligaments, so I had to do something else, which could be fine too. The good thing about breaking your ligaments when you're 19 is that you never live to disappoint your fans. And that is what happens after all to most soccer players, is that they are really promising at a young age, but then nothing happens after that. So the good thing is that in my hometown, I have a feeling that they remember me as a better and better football player as each year pass. By now I'm sort of the lost Maradona. I'm just sitting still, not saying nothing, it's just, let them remember me that way. That's That's a good thing.
I'm in conversation with the lost Maradona of Norway. His name is Joe Nesbø. He's a best-selling crime fiction writer. He's written a series of crime fiction novels featuring his character Harry Hole, or Harry Hula. Actually, how do you say that in Norwegian, Harry Hula?
In Norwegian, it's Harry Hula.
Okay. But you don't mind us saying Harry Hole?
No, that's fine.
That's fine. So since you said the broken ligaments meant you had to refocus, what did you refocus on? Where did you go to from there?
I studied what you study when you don't know what you want to study, and that is economics and business administration. So I did that for 5 years, and then I went on to become a financial analyst.
We're jumping ahead a bit here. Didn't you join the Air Force for a while?
Oh, yeah. I was there for 2 years.
Where did you serve?
I went up north in Norway. I found a really deserted place because at the end of high school, I didn't focus really on doing my maths and physics and the other subjects. So I had to get better grades in order to get into the universities where I wanted to study. So I was sitting up in a deserted place in the ice in the north of Norway.
What, the Arctic Circle?
Yeah, well, north of the Arctic Circle. So it would be the winter I spent there. It was no daylight, perfect for studying. And so I got the grades I had to get, and then I started. Yeah, then I went to university.
How important is that part of your life? The reason why I went back to it, because I don't know, just looking at your life story, it seems like maybe you got some real iron in you then, didn't you? I mean, some real will to do something different and resolve into your life at that point.
Well, I guess it was a really important point in my life, because up until then, I'd been surfing through life.
Relying on talent.
School yeah. came easy to me, and same with sports. So I always found the easy way out. I wasn't really the working kind of guy. But when I broke my ligaments and I realized I couldn't get into the universities I wanted to get into, then suddenly I realized that perhaps I'll try working hard. See how that feels and what that is all about. And so it was the first time in life that I actually set a goal for myself, and I made a plan, long-term plan, and I followed that plan. So every morning I would get up and I would study, and it was a totally different kind of life for me.
That's what strikes me. I mean, here you are, you're about to sort of, well, you have the promise anyway of becoming an important soccer player, and instead there you are in the Arctic Circle in a cabin somewhere studying hard to finish your high school education.
Mm.
That's not what you thought you'd be doing at the age of 16, is it?
No, it wasn't. You would think, isn't that really depressing? But like I said, it's when you're 19, you use... I studied a little psychology, and there I read an interesting piece of research that human beings, when they experience trauma... how long do they need to focus? And the answer is, well, about 3 weeks. depending on what kind of trauma. But in my case, I just, broke the ligaments in my knees. I had to come up with a different occupation. Most people, they experience much more serious trauma than that. But so I guess for me, it wasn't like I just had to start over again and rethink my life, or my near future, at least. When you're 19, you don't know what life, what the future has in hold for you. So don't worry, really. And for me, it was an experience of the labor or the fruits of labor. It was the first time in my life that I really was able to get something from working hard. Up till then, I had sort of despised working hard. If you didn't get anything based on your talent, it wasn't worth getting. That was how I was. How I saw it up until then.
So as you say, you got the grades and got into economics and business administration and became a stockbroker in Oslo. So how did music then start to become a part of your life while you're doing this high-powered stockbroking job?
All my friends, they played in bands, and I didn't play at all. I used to write lyrics for my friends and their bands. So it wasn't until I was 22 that I picked up a guitar, and I learned like three chords, or actually just two chords. I wasn't able to play the rest of the chords that was in the book with the chords that I had bought, so I made up my own chords. And as a student, there was a guy who came into the cantina and asked if there was anybody there who could play the guitar and to join his band. And I said I could play the guitar and can, at least I can, I know three chords. And so I was in the band. And after I'd finished studying, I went on to form another band with my brother. And we played at a local club in Oslo. We were so bad that because we played there every weekend, the bass player, he worked at the club, so he made sure that we got one gig, then another gig, and we were so cheap that they would actually hire us again. But what we did in order to have people come back the next week was that we would change the name of the band every week. And
I never heard that one before. That's really smart.
Yeah, it worked for us. But after a year of having played there, we sort of got better, and people started asking for are those guys going to play next week? And that was the name we ended up with, De Derre, which means those guys. So we went on, and we one day a guy from a TV show walked in, and he liked what he heard. He liked the lyrics of the songs, and he asked me if I could write a song for his TV program. And we did. It was a song about a ski jumper, and he was jumping. It was late December, and just as he was jumping, as he was going into the air, the lights were gone. And this was based on a true story. And this song became a hit. And so we got a record deal. We made an album. It didn't sell very much. But we slowly built a fan base playing live. And 2 years later, we recorded our second album. And it was a great hit. And suddenly we were the best-selling band in Norway. And I wouldn't say it changed my life or our lives, but it was a strange life, because I tried to keep my life normal. I had a day job. The rest of the band, they were full-time musicians at the time.
So you kept going to work, did you? Even though you were a kind of best-selling pop star.
I liked the normal life that you had, that you on Monday you actually had to get up in the morning and go to job. I like that, because, you know, I just felt that I didn't want to be a rock and roll star, you know, 24 hours a day. I want to be a, you know, I like this Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde existence, that at night I could go out and be this rock and roll animal. But so when I woke up, I was normal again.
No, I mean, Norway is, you know, like Australia, it's kind of plugged into this big, largely American-dominated international culture. Was the reason why your band was successful is because you were singing in Norwegian for a start and telling Norwegian stories?
Yeah, I guess so. We were never, you know, the best band technically. It was definitely about the songs and the lyrics and the stories of the songs.
So there you are, still doing this day job. And what was the turning point then? How did that all had to come to an end at some point? It must have been hugely demanding on your time and energy. When did you know you had to make a change?
Well, it was, I think, 3 years after our breakthrough. We had played 180 gigs in 1 year, and my day would more or less be like this. I would be at the stock exchange from 9 to 4, and then the stock exchange would close, a bell would ring, and I would just grab my bag, run into the street, get a cab to go to the airport, and then go to wherever my band was at that time. They were traveling with a nightliner or a bus. And I would be there maybe in time for the sound check, hopefully in time for the gig. And after the gig, the rest of the guys, they would, of course, go off to some party with some beautiful blonde girls. And I would head back to the hotel to get some hours sleep, take the first plane back to Oslo, hopefully in time for when the stock exchange opened at 9 o'clock. I'll be there working to 4 o'clock, grab my bag, run into the street, get a cab, go back to the airport. And after 1 year living like that, I had to take some time off. I had to get away from it all. And I decided that going to Australia, that was getting away.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio. Broadcast, podcast, and online.
Joe Nesbø is with me, one of the world's best-selling crime fiction authors. He's from Norway, written 9 books so far that feature his detective character, Harry Hole, and the latest one is called Phantom. Joe, you were telling me how you were a Norwegian pop star by night, stockbroker by day, and then you decided to get away and come to Australia. What happened on the plane?
I gave birth to Harry Hole.
Was it a messy birth?
Well, yes, in a way it was, because I didn't really know what I wanted with him. Or I did know that I wanted to write something, and that it was probably a crime novel. I've been asked by a girl I knew who worked at the publishing house whether I could write a book about the band traveling on the road. But I had, of course, told her that what happens on the road stays on the road.
Yes, that's right.
And but I said that, okay, maybe I'll give you something else. So I went to Australia. I was traveling with a friend of mine. He was there for 2 weeks, and then he went back. And I spent 3 more weeks in Australia. My plan originally was to travel around Australia and really explore the country. But what happened was that the first night I got there, I was jet-lagged. On the plane, I had come up with this idea of the character Harry Hole and a plot, or half a plot. And I started writing the first night when I got to Sydney, because I was jet-lagged. I couldn't sleep. So I had this Harry Hole character checking into the same hotel where I lived. And for the next 5 weeks, I sort of followed in the footsteps of Harry around Australia, or maybe it was the other way around. The last 3 weeks, I didn't see anything of Australia at all. I locked myself into a hotel room in King's Cross in Sydney, and I would just, you know, spend 16 hours a day just writing and writing, running out to grab a meal and then go back to my little dark hotel room, writing about Harry, of course, staying in King's Cross.
That story really had bitten deep into you then.
It was, you know, for me, it was the kick for, I don't know, doing some kind of drug for the first time. It was as if I'd been waiting my whole life to write, not this novel, but writing a novel. I'd been writing lyrics, short stories, but I was 37 at the time. And as soon as I'd written the first 2 pages, I knew that this is something that I will have to do for the rest of my life. And why didn't I do this before? And when I came back home, I did rewrite it a little bit. But I sort of sent the publishing house a script that I had spent 5 weeks writing, and it was 300 pages. I didn't expect them to, you know, publish it, of course.
And under your name?
No, I actually used a pseudonym, because I was you know, the singer in Did That Is, so I didn't want them to use that as an excuse to publish a really bad novel, hoping that at least some of his fans are going to buy the novel. But what happened was that after 3 weeks, they phoned me, and they said that we are interested in this novel that you sent us. Can you come over? And of course I could. I was really excited, and I met 4 older guys who were sitting in a room looking at me, and one of them asked that, we understand that this is not your real name. Is that right? Yes, I said, it's not my name. So why didn't you use your own name? Well, I said, it's because I'm Joe Nesbø, and nobody had heard about Joe Nesbø or my band. So it was... So I told them that, okay, I'm the singer in this band, and I hope you will give the novel a chance. And they did. It was called The Batman. It's one of the few novels that haven't been, we didn't sell that abroad because it was featuring a Norwegian detective in Australia. We figured that was a bit far-fetched for foreign readers, but now it's getting translated. So you'll probably see it here in Australia, perhaps this year. The name will be not The Batman.
Apparently there's another fictional character.
Character of fiction who's not too happy with me using that that title. So it'll be called The Bat.
So you wrote this hold up in a hotel room. It sounds like you were in a hurry.
I was. I had 5 weeks, like I said, and I was getting back. I was going to work as a stockbroker again. And
more than that, though, I mean, in a hurry. It's like you said, you realized you wanted to do this for the rest of your life. What, you say 35 that you were?
I was 37.
37.
I guess the reason why because when I came back, the first thing I did was to go back to work. I turned on my computer. I can remember, you know, it was 8 o'clock in the morning. I turned on my computer and I was waiting for the screen to lit up, you know, to look at the usual numbers, so Dow Jones and dollar rate and oil price and stuff like that. And I realized that I am in a hurry and I don't have time for this. I have to write. I can't be here. I have to be at home writing. And I guess the reason why I was assured that I didn't have time or that I had to do this now was that my father had died 2 years earlier. He was 72. It was his first year of retirement. And he had always planned to write a novel about his wartime experiences when he fought with the Germans against the Russians outside St. Petersburg. And he never had the time to write that novel. And I realized that you can't postpone the things that you know you have to do in life. So I realized that, okay, this is the time. I know what I have to do now, and I'm not going to postpone it. I'm going to do it right now.
It was a story, your father's story was something you wanted to tell, but you waited till you were ready to tell it, didn't you?
That's right. It's my third novel, The Red Breast, is based on the experiences of my father. Not only what he experienced in the trenches when he was there, with his comrades, but also, you know, the choices he made before he got there, which was very interesting to me. You know, how does an 18-year-old kid decide that he wants to fight for Hitler?
When did you realize yourself that your father had had this interesting past?
I didn't know anything about it until I was 15. That was when he, my older brother, he had known for a couple of years. But my father told him when he was 15. And when I was 15, you know, I had grown up with the same war movies and so on. So I saw, you know, any soldier with a German helmet, I saw as, you know, the devil himself. So for me to sort of imagine my father with a German helmet, that was a shock to me.
How did you discover that he had been doing that?
Well, I saw a picture at a museum and I saw something written there. It was some kind of note saying that you could go outdoors in the town of Molde, who you had to report to in case of a fire, in case of bombing and so on. And I saw my father's name there. So I realized that my father must have had something to do with this. And then I asked my father, what is this? And then he sat down with me and he said, I was going to tell you this later this year, but now you already know. So here's what I did during the war.
And what did he tell you he'd done during the war?
He told me about arriving in Norway from America in 1930s. And he told me how he saw the world in 1939 and 1940. He saw the weak European democracies like France and England. And he saw two strong countries with two strong leaders, Hitler and Stalin. And he said, the way I saw it, we had to make a choice between those two guys. And Russia had borders to Norway. And Germany was, after all, a country that we as Scandinavians felt closer to culturally. So he said that I volunteered to fight with the Germans, not to fight for Hitler, but to fight for Norwegians and for Norway against the Russians. That's how I saw it. But he also told me that after the war, he was punished. He had to go to jail for 3 years. And he said, actually, I think that 3 years in prison for being as wrong as I was, that was a fair punishment.
So he fought at the Siege of St. Petersburg. I mean, the Siege of Leningrad is one of the most extraordinary, mad periods in the whole of that war.
He would tell me most of the details that's in the book, The Red Breast. It's not only based on my father's story. It's my father's stories. It's all in there. He told me about this New Year's Eve when he was sitting in the trenches talking to a friend. You had to be careful, of course, to keep your head low when you were in the trenches. My father's friend, he forgot for a couple of seconds, put his head up a little too high. And in the middle of a sentence, they were talking about, you know, New Year's Eve in Norway, and how much they longed back, how they longed for proper food. There was a popping sound, and his friend's head exploded inside the helmet, and there were blood all over the place. And he was, he was dead. He was gone. And it was 20 below zero. And the first thing my father had to do was to disassemble the machine gun because his friend's, blood and brain tissue was all over the weapon. And so it had to disassemble it, clean it, and put it together again. And that was how he spent his New Year's Eve that year.
And meanwhile, inside Leningrad, the citizens there were reduced to cannibalism.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It was about as bad as one of the worst places that...
Yeah, he always told me that you had people deserting all the time because it was hard to be a soldier on both sides. But he said that they realized that the Russians probably had it worse because he said that when you saw Russian deserters coming over to their trenches, they were so starved that it was a good thing for their morale because it stopped German soldiers deserting the other way.
Norway's got a complicated history with it. It's like France, isn't it? There was a resistance and then there were collaborators with the Germans. How did that go over? Was Norway ready to hear that story that you'd written?
I think at the time when I wrote that novel, things were changing a little bit. Up until then, Norway is a young nation. It won its independence in 1905. And it's important for a young nation to have their sort of heroic stories about themselves. It's important for the self-image. And I think that for Norway, the most important stories were the stories about the polar explorers like Amundsen and Nansen and the Norwegian resistance during World War II. But of course, if you look at what really happened during World War II, it's not black and white. It was probably just as many people who fought for the Germans as there were people who fled from the country and joined the Allied forces. And I think that the people that volunteered and fought for the Germans, at least they put their life on the line for what they believed in. So although they were punished with 3 years in prison, I think that my father, he never had, any problems with other people, he might have lost a job or two, but, apart from that, I think there was some kind of shame that Norwegians felt that they had been occupied by this nation, and it was the English, and the Russians, and late in the war, the Americans that fought the war. And they were just, most of them were just leading a normal life. Actually, health, the health improved a lot in Norway during the war. World Wars. So Norwegians, you know, they it was life not as normal. That's exaggerating it, but it wasn't like, you know, the worst crisis Norway ever had.
How shocking was it for you to hear that about your dad? I mean, like you said, you didn't have those pictures of people in Norway doing these things during the war.
My father was, you know, he was one of the people I admired the most. So I had to really sit down, and it was hard for me. I had to ask him questions like, did you know about the concentration camps? And he would answer me as honestly as he could. And he would say that, you can ask me anything. The concentration camps, I heard about them. I knew that Hitler wasn't fond of Jews. But when we heard about the concentration camps and Jews actually being gassed, we didn't believe that. There were all kinds of stories, you know, in wartime, all kinds of rumors. 90% of them went true. So I didn't believe that, he said.
It's tempting to say everything in your life sort of makes its way into your writing, but it's certainly true that a lot of people who'd heard those rumours about what was going on in the Second World War just couldn't believe it, because that's just so weird. Mm. And of course it was true. Do you find sometimes writing fiction that reviewers will go, oh, human beings aren't capable of such things?
Mm. It is a fact that reality will always, you know, be worse or more extreme than any fiction you can come up with. And I think recent events in Norway, like the massacre of Utøya, of course, it just goes to show that, you know, these are things that if you wrote it in a book, people would go, you know, that's far too extreme, that's far too unrealistic. What a single human is capable of, there's no limit to it, I believe.
When Martin Bryant went on a murderous rampage in Tasmania in Australia in 1996, it really shocked Australia. We went, you know, what's happening to this country? And of course, then it happens in another country, and then they say, what's happening to this country? Is that what happened to Norway after that massacre in Utøya last year?
It's the kind of event that will stay with us for the rest of our lives, at least my generation and probably the next generation also. It's too soon to tell whether it will, you know, change the nation and the psyche of the nation. I don't think it'll change Norway the way, for example, 9/11 changed America.
No.
Because it's this was seemingly an insane individual who committed this murder. In America, they had to ask themselves the questions, why does so many people hate us? In Sweden, when the Prime Minister Olof Palme was killed, they never found the murderer, and they never know why Olof Palme was murdered. So they have to live with that trauma. In Norway, he was caught right away, and he had reasons, as at least tried to explain reasons why he did this massacre. And so it may be that, you know, in the future, we will regard this more like a natural disaster, like an earthquake or something, more than, you know, some important political statement or something in our culture that made this inevitable, that this sooner or later will happen. Like I said, it's too soon to tell yet. But what I am sure about is that what happened will seep through in the writing of writers like myself, not only crime writers, but any writer. It's there in the backs of our heads. In what way you will see it in writing, I'm not sure yet, but I just know it will be there. Even now when I'm writing a crime novel, anything that I write that are, you know, anywhere close to what happened at Utøya, I will have to consider, you know, how this is read by Norwegians, because you know that your readers, it's there all the time, the images of the massacre.
I've read what you've written about Oslo, and you write about it with real affection as a very gentle and sweet place. Did it jolt your sense of the kind of gentleness of Norway?
Not really. I would say actually the opposite, because what happened in Norway was that the people and the Prime Minister, their first reaction was that we will not let this change the country. And I remember they had a meeting in the Labour Party, and there were no security. All the top politicians were there, and they sort of consciously made sure that there were no security. Less security than there usually is, just to make a point that we are not going to let this get us paranoid. We have an open society where we trust each other, and we will not let that be taken away from us. So, and what happened, the way the people sort of got together, and it was, you know, it's easy, of course, when the murder is caught, there's no trauma, there's no political discussion. But still, I mean, people made the effort to tell each other that, let's sit down, take a look at what we have, what values we have, and really appreciate them. So I think it was, the best hour of our people, you know, in many ways. And I was quite touched with it. I normally don't get touched with, you know, big crowds and too much flag waving. But actually that was, just humans getting together. And I was touched by it.
Joe, I know you're friends with the Prime Minister of Norway, who's probably the most outrageous hipster that's ever led a nation in the history of the world. Like, you know, he's well-dressed. Someone said he's got the thinnest lapels of any suit in NATO. He's a friend of yours. Is it the kind of place Oslo is? It a small city where people are friends, just, you know, hang
well,
out with the Prime Minister?
I wouldn't say he's a friend of mine, but he's an acquaintance. He's a friend of a friend of
mine. You and a bunch of guys and the Prime Minister went riding on a bike outside of Oslo, and you all went skinny dipping in a water hole.
Yeah,
that by if you swim naked with someone, by definition, you are friends with them. I would put you so.
Okay, yeah, but you have to understand that people in Norway, they do a lot of, you know, bathing naked together. But it is that kind of country. Yeah, I was in the Faroe Islands once, and I was sitting there having a lunch. And then a guy and a woman came in during lunch and said that we just popped in to say hello, and I'm the Prime Minister of the Faroe Islands. you know, in small countries, it's not such a big deal that you are on friendly terms with the Prime Minister. We're just a population of 4.5 million, so it's more like the mayor of a middle-sized city. But anyway, I think it's a good thing that, you know, you are in a country where everybody are on a first name term with the Prime Minister. It would be very unusual for somebody to call Jens Stoltenberg Mr. Stoltenberg. The normal thing would be to call him Jens.
So you live in Oslo, which is the city, which is a really nice place to live by the sound of things. It sounds fantastic. I'm interested in the fact that in your writing then, Joe, you keep bringing monsters into this town all the time.
Well, I write fiction, and it's not like Oslo is a city of monsters. It's, on the other hand, it's not the innocent village it used to be 20 years ago. Oslo has always, ever since the 70s, been a drug city. Heroin was brought into Oslo in the early 70s, and it's always had a high rate of deaths from overdoses. But it wasn't until, I guess, 15 years ago that you really saw organized crime coming into to Oslo, and prostitution to the extent that you see prostitution now, human trafficking.
What's changed?
I think that Oslo opened up to the world, to the rest of Europe. Most of the things that happened because of that are good things, but not all of them. So Oslo has changed as a city, but it's still, you know, a safe city. It's not the Oslo that I use in the Harry Hole series. It's 99% the real Oslo, but it is a little darker, a little more twisted. So just like the Batman's
Gotham City
is a version of New York City, then Harry's Oslo is a darker, bigger version of the real Oslo.
So while we might recognize the world it's actually kind of like a parallel reality, isn't it?
Yeah.
When you create these kind of fictions. Well, it's been great to talk to you in this reality, Joe. It's been fantastic meeting you. Thank you so much for being my guest.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.